Game Boys.
Hello, Internet. Welcome to the Game Boys podcast. It's me, your host, Lux, and I'm here, as always, with our good friend, Griffin Davis. I'm not doing a special intro because this episode itself is very special. We're not doing a full one. It's like a bonus segment situation. But Griffin, how's it going before I explain what we're doing today?
Don't waste any specialness on me. We've got a very special guest. We have to save all of our special juice for.
Yeah. Well, we also have another guest this week, so like I can't think of two intros for you. That would be crazy. That would be exhausting.
I think we always should start with asking what we're playing this week. So Lux, what are you playing right now?
I'm still on Slay the Spire. I've been trying to wineskin Frostpunk so I can play it on my computer, but it is not going well.
Okay, well, I've been playing something very exciting, the Kingdom Hearts 2 remaster.
Oh yeah,
it's
the first time I've ever on Twitch.
I streamed it on Twitch. It was my first Twitch stream ever. It lasted 3 minutes and then I got bored. But I bought a Twitch camera. So now you guys can see me finish Kingdom Hearts 2. And by you guys, I mean the 10 people listening right now.
All right. To be fair, our average listeners have gone a lot up since they were at 10 an episode.
Oh, like, nice. I haven't checked.
Yeah. It's like almost 25 or 30.
But I'm very excited about this episode. I don't know if this is a mini episode or what, but I'm very excited because we're bringing on a guest that we've mentioned a lot on this show. It's kind of a big part of the origin story of this podcast.
Yeah,
definitely,
pillar of the mythology for sure.
Yeah. I think I would like to welcome to the podcast Lux's dad. Do I call Rabbi Luxemburg?
Yeah, Rabbi Jack Luxemburg.
Jack will do.
Jack will do. Perfect. Dad. Welcome to the podcast, Jack. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me. Let's talk video games.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Lux always mentions that he was able to experience video games at a young age because you were a video game fan. And that's kind of a rare relationship for video gamers.
I suppose it's so. Listen, I grew up spending summers on the Jersey Shore. Long Beach Island, New Jersey.
Cool.
And there was ocean, sand, and pinball. It was 1950s. Arcades with pinball machines and skee ball and real soda fountains. And it was pinball for me. And I think we recognize that pinball is the precursor for so many of the games. Just the electronic games, not so much... sophisticated games that we play today, the RPGs, etc., but video games in general. A lot of the engineering, a lot of the electronics had their root in the really creative pinball tables.
Yeah, pinball is interesting. It's like, because I feel like gaming started at these like arcades or whatever. Right. Like people would try and get their high score, get their name on the things. But then did those same people then transfer to console gaming, to buying consoles? Or was it only a few of you guys that kind of migrated to the next generation?
By 1971 or two, I was working at Ohio State University. And by that, and there was an arcade, but you could hardly find a pinball game. You found the electronic game consoles, you know, like the Pac-Man and the Joust.
Mm-hmm. Joust.
Right.
God, what a terrible game.
all the games that ultimately ended up on our home TVs with Atari and and its ilk. So then you have, and then you had the very beginnings, right, of like the RPGs, you know, the 8-pixel games.
Right, you had like Adventure and stuff.
Adventure, you know, and then we had Game Boys, those great electronic babysitters,
Ding.
Right?
Yeah, you know, so from my experience, when I talk to adults about so video accurate. Games, from my experience, it's like, it's always like, yeah, like they, a lot of adults, like so even my parents have those experiences with those arcade games, but they never continued the trajectory. Like an RPG is so different from a pinball game that it's like, it's interesting to me that you still like you kept through the generations, you know, and the evolutions of gaming.
I think I would make this observation that on the really sophisticated tables, there were narrative elements. You unlock, you know, if you're lucky enough to get the silver ball to go in the right place, the right hole, hit the right combination of targets, something happened to push a story that the table represented forward. And remember that some of the really sophisticated tables were linked, as they are today, still, television shows like Star Trek, Star Wars,
oh, yeah. I just played the Game of Thrones pinball machine down the street.
All right, so
how'd that go, Griff?
Badly. I'm not good.
You're not sitting on the Iron Throne?
I was a kind of a Ned Stark.
Oh no!
Yeah,
I hit the Ned Stark hole
after the third ball.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So, well, Dad, you at least in my experience, being your son and all, I was growing up, you played. You were playing. We didn't have like a console for the TV. You played computer games. That's what we grew up doing.
Well, do you remember? I can't remember the author, but do you remember the Rift World novels?
Oh yeah, well, the Rift World, wasn't that Raymond E. Feist?
Yes. One of the very first RPGs that I remember playing was based on one of those novels. It was placed in that world, and I had enjoyed those novels, and so I picked it up. It was very text-heavy.
Yeah, as we've actually talked about this on the podcast, that watching you and Daniel play that game is like a big part of how I learned how to read.
Well, by the way, it's a big part how Daniel learned to read.
Well, so both of us were raised
that's
by learning,
really cool.
Learning how to read from a trailer condor.
It was very text-heavy. Uh-huh. And in our house, there was a lot of reading. We did a lot of reading. Mom and I did a lot of reading to you.
Yep.
And there was a point where I was wondering why your brother Daniel, who's very bright, was not reading on his own. Part of it was I realized looking back is he liked to be with us and be read to. So I would sit with him and we would play the game. And we would start, and it was very text heavy, and we would start playing our own game. Like, I read one word, Daniel, you have to read the next word. Back and forth.
We did stuff like that when I was a youth.
And finally, Griffin, what happened was Daniel became so impatient to find out what happened next that he would go down, turn on the computer, and play the game. And finally, he would read because he wanted to know what was going to happen.
Oh, that's great. So you kind of taught your son how to read through video games, is what you're saying?
I'm saying, a duology of sons, actually.
I would say there was the video game provided an incentive. And let's not forget that even today, it's use of video game playing is used as an educational device in many instances.
I can remember Assassin's Creed just released their educational only version where you can experience all of the landmarks of Egypt without engaging with any of like the action or violence. Like you can just learn about Egypt.
But how about the games where the games that were played for letter recognition? Mm-hmm. You know, with young, especially these days when people are very visually oriented, when it seems kids are born computer savvy, right? So all this, I think, comes very natural.
That's really interesting because I think most parents view video games as trash or just like entertainment or like almost worse than watching TV. Did you ever have that fear that video games were gonna like corrupt your kids through some of their stuff, or was that never on your radar?
I have to say honestly, it never occurred to me because if they were gonna be corrupted, I was already corrupt. They never had any chances, right? I tend to RPGs. I mm-hmm. tend to fantasy RPGs because I like that. And maybe some science fiction RPGs. Like I liked Mass Effect a lot. Mm-hmm. But personally, I've always tended away from games. Even, you know, I like the games which on the label says fantasy violence.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't like shooting games where I'm shooting at other human beings.
I remember as a kid.
Yeah, like I wasn't allowed to bring Grand Theft Auto into my house. Never. So I had to borrow my neighbor's and then sneak it into the house to play it.
Well, see, that never came up for us because I also sort of inherited just by like osmosis the same like I never liked playing. I still don't really like playing games where you shoot. I mean, you've heard me complain about shooting games all the time, Griffin. I don't like games where you shoot people. And I think that's probably a related thing because I grew up on, you know, Diablo with Dad, Betrayal mm-hmm. of Condor with Dad, et cetera,
sure,
et cetera.
Sure, sure. Yeah, killing a demon is different than killing a bystander.
Yeah, precisely so. The butcher wanted to eat me.
Well, that's super cool. I want to ask a few more questions just about your life. Now, are you a retired rabbi? Is that the profession title?
I think I like to use rabbi emeritus. I was rabbi in a congregation in Rockville, Maryland for 35 years.
Okay.
And I stepped aside from the day-to-day leadership of the congregation. I have a wonderful successor, but I'm still connected to the congregation. So like a professor emeritus is still connected and has some responsibilities and some accessibility to students and his or her university. I still have the same type of working relationship with my congregants and with the professional staff. So I like the term rabbi emeritus.
Yeah, well, I think there's a certain degree, Griffin, and you'll be able to relate to this, where the same way that you and I kind of need to get on stage and perform in front of people, I think every once in a while dad needs to rabbi around some people to like feel okay.
Sure. I suppose that's true.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I admit to it.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. You're talking to two people who've dedicated their whole lives to getting people to pay attention to them. So it's totally
We were talking about RPGs and fantasy and kind of like some, like how like they have interesting stories. Mm-hmm. Do you find that, has a video game been able to tell a story about religion, or do you think they have the ability to?
Well, they certainly have the ability to, and I do believe that out there, maybe not in mass market, there are games that have been created to reflect biblical stories and different religious traditions. But if we can step back from any particular faith grouping, I mean, most religious traditions have master stories. Most religious traditions have master stories that I think we might agree follow, we'll call it the heroic arc or the quest arc narrative.
The monomyth.
Sure, the hero's journey. Sure, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Talking about the monomyth, Dad.
The monomyth?
Yeah.
Okay, go Jung.
I vomit on psychology. Anyway.
So, but what I'm getting at is that one of the things that appealed to me about RPGs is that they follow, in the main, right, the quest narrative, the heroic mm-hmm. growth narrative, somewhere, and religious traditions, I think, are all about that, and whether it's about a master story that has an ideal model, a personality, or is about the one's own journey, one's own quest, to not only to reach a goal, but to experience along the journey some type of transformative moment. And I think that most RPGs, where you play as a character, follows a similar dynamic. You progress through a heroic arc. There are moments of transformation. And today, the games are so sophisticated that they branch, much like the narrative of a human life. Based on the decisions that you make, you get different paths through the game. You even get, in some instances, different outcomes.
Right. You mentioned Mass Effect earlier. Mass Effect's a good example of that, of a game that has way different outcomes based on like your choices and introduces some morality choices too.
I also think Mass Effect is, Griffin, you mentioned like games that confront ideas of religion. I think Mass Effect is like maybe the best sort of mainstream one in the way that a lot of it is sort of focused on how you live and like what ethics mean and like sort of beliefs in higher systems. Like, I mean, you have like, they have like a knockoff Israel-Palestine conflict with the Geth and they said it.
Okay.
My point is that they do get into a lot of the mythologies of the nation formation, stuff like that. And I think that the Mass Effect really is like one of the best games in that respect. Like, it gets into a lot mm-hmm. of ideas of like what being a person means and what you're supposed to do. And mm-hmm. I think that that's really fascinating stuff. Dad, I also, Rory, our last guest, upon hearing that you were coming on, asked me to ask if there's anything, if you've ever, like, because I know you're pretty well versed in like Talmud Midrash, the Judaism extended universe, for lack of a better phrase. And I was wondering if there's any games that like spark that kind of stuff or bring any of that stuff to mind for you. So I'm very curious, because I think a lot of those ideas are very cool.
That is a really good question, which I think I'd have to think about. I think what appeals to me about the RPG genre, especially these days, is exactly what you've touched on, is about what kind of person, what kind of system of values do you bring to playing the game, especially as a game that gives you that opportunity. Even in the old Dungeons and Dragons, right, you chose a sort of a profile that reflected a certain ethic. You were chaotic, you were neutral.
Right, you had your alignment chart.
Alignment. But alignment also meant how you perceived and how you acted in the world. And you had to, the alignment didn't make sense in the game playing if you didn't act accordingly. In other words, if your actions didn't reflect your alignment.
Right.
Yeah, there's certain games where it's like you're the good guy, but also this good guy has to shoot up every single person he meets. And like that doesn't always connect.
Right. And so what I'm saying is that in maybe a very rudimentary sense, going all the way back to Dungeons and Dragons and the like, when you chose an alignment, you were essentially saying and I don't mean to be punny about this, but you know, how do you align yourself with the world? How are you living in the world? And that sort of should be reflected in your actions, right? And that's the same, I think, with most. I think every religious tradition would say that if your beliefs are genuine, and that's how you align yourself with the world, then those beliefs are not just to be professed. Those beliefs should be reflected in how you live in a way that if I didn't know who you were, if I didn't know what tradition you came from, I could hopefully discern some insight into what your beliefs were by observing how you lived in the world, how you interacted, the type of decisions that you made. And I have to admit that I always play the role playing game as a person with a good alignment trying to.
That was my question, have you ever gone bad?
I have to tell you, I don't believe I ever had. I think that, and I think that that's the challenge. I think that's, uh-huh. And I think that's a profoundly religious challenge. And that is, how do you make your way, just as it's a challenge to make your way through the game, right, as a good character with all the.
Sure.
Compromises and all the decisions you may have to make. Mm-hmm. Isn't religion about finding your way through the world, hopefully as a good person?
Sure.
And I think that there's an analog there. And so to the extent that as a religious person, I try to make my way through the world as a good human being and a person who is concerned about good in the world, that's why I like to play my game. I think that's, for me, otherwise, I think I would be very uncomfortable. I'm not sure how to play evil.
you wouldn't be down to play the evil,
the dark rabbi. Actually, that's Griffin. I mean, we've talked about this before. Like, that's why I wasn't playing neutral, is because Dad used to give me some shit whenever I would like kill the civilians, and eventually I like internalized that. And so now the worst I get is like weird neutral when I play those kind of games.
Right, yeah, like I always bring up this game called Undertale on this podcast, and it's a game that it's all about morality in a way that a lot of games haven't. It's really interesting. Basically, you are playing this little kid, and you encounter monsters, and you can choose to either kill the monsters or befriend them. And so there's a passive route and a hostile route, and it changes the game completely based on if you're befriending these monsters or killing them. Mm-hmm. And it gave a really interesting choice that I hadn't seen before in a game. I think what some games are doing is taking this idea of morality to an even more interesting level. I think basic games that started with morality were like, you can be a good person or you can be a bad person. And I think games are starting to introduce like shades of gray now. I'd mention a game, The Witcher 3. I don't know if you've played The Witcher 3.
I haven't played 3.
3 is really great. I haven't played the first two, but what they would introduce is like these kind of like shades of gray. Like you weren't the center character that's going to save the universe. You're just a kind of a bounty hunter that's experiencing both sides of this war. And so it's like there isn't always clear good guys and clear bad guys. And your choices aren't always as clear as do the good thing or do the bad thing. And I think that's like an interesting evolution of this.
I mean, and that's and I know you play The Witcher 2, Dad, because we've talked about it. And that's like a huge part of The Witcher 2, because the whole hinge of The Witcher 2 is that at the beginning of the game, there's a war between the elves and these guys. Mm-hmm. And your first sort of quest mission, you have to pick a side, and that changes the whole line of the game. And no matter which side you pick, you get confronted with like the bads and the goods of it in a very real way, which is, I mean, why The Witcher games are some of my favorites. But all right, let's get to some of the stuff we normally talk about rather than smart people stuff that makes Griffin and I sound silly. What are you playing right now, Dad? What's going on right now on the old console?
Well, I downloaded the most recent patch for Diablo 3.
Nice.
Going strong.
Classic.
And so I played it through as a necromancer.
Nice.
Which I thought was an interesting take, because the necromancer is not necessarily intrinsically an evil person, but a person who's interested in maintaining the proper balance between life and death, between growth and decay. Mm-hmm. I think that without the occult overlay, I think there's some really fundamental, you know, religious, spiritual dimensions there to explore. So, and then they have they've added this dynamic where you play a season, you pick a character, and you play through a season with certain types of goals. And it's still the same narrative arc. It's still the same acts. It's still this, you know. But I happen to enjoy that game. The reason I enjoy it is because I beat it. You know, I'm not always able to see. I have to admit, to easily beat certain games or see them all the way through to the end.
Yeah, that's one big difference in how you and I play games, because I will play a game all the way to the end, even if I hate it.
Well,
I'll bail eventually, like if there's a game for the show, like Sunless Sea.
I also, of course, I enjoyed the Tolkien universe, so I played,
Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You played both of them, right?
I played both of them, and I actually just recently downloaded the latest DLC, the download content for the second of those two games.
Shadow of War. Yeah, I mean, to go back to the past, I remember, I mean, one of the things that y'all read to me as a kid when I was very young was the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and one of the first things I read in like the first grade as like a kid who learned how to read was Lord of the Rings trilogy at the beach. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Tolkien stuff has been around for... has been a foundational text for the family forever.
Right. Well, you know, I was in college in the late 60s when everybody sort of rediscovered Tolkien. You know? Mm. And so it was very, I think that just sort of set me on that path. I've enjoyed the high fantasy since. And those two games I found were an interesting take on the Tolkien lore.
Right. Well, to get back to your interest in like sort of morality and performative morality in video games, like that, those games raise a lot of questions about that, where you're like taking over people's minds and making them do horrible things that they probably wouldn't want to do. And you sort of have to reckon with the effects of that, right? Like that is sort of a built-in component of that game.
Well, I think one of the reasons I like the game is precisely because it raises those questions. And at least starts out in the heroic posture, Talion,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talion. By the end of that second game, he's essentially a ring wraith in terms of how they developed his arc.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Am I, is that a spoiler alert?
No. It's an obvious fact that I just didn't think about.
And welcome to the Game Boys podcast, Dad.
Okay. All right. Well, but I think that's interesting, and it's because... it's his choices. I mean, that narrative is sort of on a rail. It's just how do you get to those climactic points, and whether and the dynamic of the game requires that you take over, you mind control people, right. You ask them, you have them fight for you, etc. But it's all part of getting Talion to the final denouement, where he essentially becomes a ring wraith, and you can see his struggle. So I think that's a game that tells a story. Yeah, you don't have much choice. You can't decide whether Talion goes in one direction or another.
Right.
It's leading to a narrative end. But I think it's done well, and they took some liberties with the Tolkien.
Yeah, like Shelob.
Yeah, but you know, it was creative. I mean, look what's going on with, you know, it's almost like fan fiction.
Sure.
You know, in a way. Yeah. I mean, the people who made that game were clearly fans, and they've expanded on the base narrative, just like fan fiction does. I mean, look what's going on with all the Star Wars stuff, whether it's fan fiction or it's you know, authorized expansions on the Star Wars universe through all the books that have been written and all the novels.
Right, and you see it with Marvel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess the thing I like most about those Shadow of the Mordor games is that they give orcs personality. And the one thing that when I rewatch the Lord of the Rings movies, I feel like the orcs are just this race of evil, dark people that, like, when they're defeated, who cares where they go? And, like, they're just, you know, they're just this, like, this other. And then, like, these games gave them, like, personality and, like, made them feel like a race of people in a way that I don't think the movies did.
No, the movies didn't. They do not. And the game gives them motivation.
Yes, I mean, absolutely.
They talk about, and some of them voice their own orcish aspirations.
Yeah, and that's great.
There's a Russian novel from the 90s, where it is the third act of The Return of the King, basically, but told from the perspective of orcs living in Mordor.
Wow.
Yeah, I got to find what it's called. I forget what it's called. I'll look it up and I'll say it whenever. Mm-hmm. I'll add
it. Yeah, because when I think about, like, really stuff good. Like today, like, oh, like when I think about, like, Game of Thrones is like the closest thing I can compare to Lord of the Rings on TV right now. Like, Game of Thrones, like, when an army is defeated, I think Game of Thrones tries to deal with the ramifications of that a little bit more, like the realities of it. And so that's what I like about this game. It just feels like a little bit more mature take on the different types of fantasy creatures.
This game sounds a lot like a game I think we've mentioned a little bit on here, like Spec Ops The Line. What, did you ever play that? I know. No. I know we talked about it because I read about it for my graduate thesis from college. But it's a similar sort of story. It's like it's a Heart of Darkness adaptation. And as you play through it, you're on rails, but you see this guy go from, like, classic Afghanistan soldier to falling apart into this, like, train wreck of a guy who's done all these terrible things and beaten up. And those kind of games that sort of, like, make you attach you to a character and then put you through some shit to tell a lesson about that character in the world they live in, I think is some of the coolest stuff you can do with video games. Like, I think... That's actually a pretty good question. Like, I think open world stuff is fascinating and it's fun, but I find that for me, the narrative, like, the most compelling video games are ones that are the narratives on rails because it has a thing to say. Do you feel similarly, Dad, or are you more of an explorer type?
In the games that are, like, really, really big, like Skyrim, or
The Witcher, Oblivion.
Right. I sometimes find myself getting lost in those games, I have to admit. That's why I like the... And while there was some exploring potential in the Mordor games, it was easy to get back on track. And some of the larger games, I admit to sort of getting lost.
It's overwhelming.
They're huge.
But yeah, but some people really enjoy that, and I can really appreciate, you know, just being in a narrative. There's a narrative environment in which you, in part, are composing the narrative yourself, and you can choose when and how to return to the, we'll say, the main quest.
Yeah, which is a mixed bag, because then you get things in Skyrim, like you're going to fight a dragon, and a small child runs up to you and is like, "Can you find my doll?" And it's like, "I'm a little busy."
I got something. Hold on, dragon, I'll be right back.
Sorry, this girl's extremely sad.
I do like a game that tells a good story.
Well, that's all. This is all great. Lux, do you have any final questions? Sure. Can you name some of the ones that you think are, like, the best stories you've seen in gaming?
Ooh. You know, I'm at an age where I don't remember everything.
That's totally right.
Now.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, different reasons, maybe. As I said, I like the Mass Effect games. I enjoyed those. The Witcher game I played, I liked.
You gotta play three.
Senua's
Sacrifice.
Yes.
You know, I found to be enormously intriguing on a lot of levels, and in some moments really difficult to play, difficult to stay with. So I'm not really good at that that twitchy combat type of stuff.
Right.
So for those little moments, I found it difficult. But I found intriguing the entire notion of that game.
That's a game that explores mental illness, I believe. Is that what it is?
In a major way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Relatable content.
What is it? The Age of Inquisition?
Dragon Age.
I enjoyed those.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what game I really enjoyed? I can't remember the name of it. And I really am not a big fan of the person who funded it. But remember years ago, Kurt Schilling?
Oh, Kingdoms of Amalur.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when we prank call Kurt Schilling for not even a show. And sometimes when I call him, I'll be like, hey, when's the next Amalur game coming out? And he'll be like, I had to shut down the studio. And I'll be like, what? Aren't you rich? And then make fun of him being an idiot. But Kurt Schilling sucks. So that game is amazing.
Yeah, the game was, that was the game. Oh, and you know what? I liked Fable.
Sure.
Okay.
I remember when we got Fable, that was you and I were playing pretty much constantly because it was just like this new, crazy, intriguing thing.
Yeah, well, it was a good-looking game. It had some branches. I thought it told a good story.
For sure.
And you know what? And I like games that have successive installments. I mean, if the game is good and justifies a sequel, and you're fortunate enough that the sequel carries the story forward and carries the gameplay to another level, builds on what was successful in the first one, it's like reading a series of novels which has engaged you, and I enjoy that. But those are some of the ones that I can remember.
No, that's great. That's more than enough. We'd like to. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This was great.
So we've got Rabbi Jack here. We all have Saint Barbara in the studio. She's in the back. But hey, Mom, say hi.
Hi.
See, she's here.
Yeah.
They're here for vacation.
But yeah, we'll definitely have to have you back on in the future. Love to maybe call you in sometimes.
That would be really great. Thank you for having me. It's nice to meet you, even if it's only digitally.
I feel like that's how I meet most people these days.
I mean, you've seen Griffin before because you've seen the Guys Night Out sketch that we did.
Yes, I did.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on. Lux, is there anything else we do for this special mini episode?
Well, we're not going to do the segments. We are going to do the outro. So, Internet, thank you so much for listening. My name is Lux. I'm your host. Your co-host is Griffin Davis. Your dad and guest is Rabbi Jack Luxenberg. Your editing is by Haley Clement. Your intro and outro music is by Matthew Morden. And your art is by Brittany Metz. Thank you very much for listening. We love you very much, Internet. We'll be right back.